Framings of Wombat Forest is an audiovisual exhibition which explores the diverse ways that people know and connect to, understand the Wombat Forest in Central Victoria. So it's about bringing together diverse voices that you might not normally find in the same room to explore the different ways that people understand this place. So their passions, their motivation. So there's a series of photographs. They're photographic portraits that are accompanied by little audio portraits that I've put together from in-depth interviews with all these different people. So they're like music and sound and their voice that has been edited together into little audio portraits, I'm calling them, of about 6 to 10 minutes each. And so each person talks about their connection to this place and kind of what they do and what they, yeah, their way of understanding this forest. And so there's timber workers and activists, there's environmentalists, field naturalists, scientists, lots of different people coming together and each offering a different contour of the forest from which they see this landscape.
Oh, that's fascinating. How did you get to this project?
It's a long story. Are you in for a long story?
Yeah, I am.
Sure. So back when I was in my early 20s, I was quite involved in the forest activism scene. So I spent a lot of time at Friends of the Earth, anywhere from, you know, door knocking and election campaigns to being out in the forest at blockades and all that stuff. And it was quite devastating as a young person to see that we were really logging these forest ecosystems heavily for mostly paper products. And a big question that kind of hung over all of that was, what happens next? Like when we've logged these ecosystems, what do they regrow as? Like how do we bring them back to good health? And what's our responsibility to that? And so, you know, we were campaigning to try and stop the logging of these forests, mostly to the east of Melbourne, I guess, is where the focus was. But what happened next was kind of not a question we were at that point. And so did a lot of that as a young person, and then I moved up to the Northern Rivers. So I was living in Lismore, really bad timing. I was there at the time of floods. The swamps had been drained. They built all the towns there in the swamp, and then they were like, why is it flooding? And, of course, the local people, the Widjiwibble, were like, you probably shouldn't build a town there. And they're like, but we need the town here because we need to, like, take the logs up and down the rivers because they were logging all of the red cedars, right? And so the town is still there in a bad place, and the floods have just gotten more and more extreme over time. So in 2022, that flood was 2 metres higher than any in the historical record. Yeah, I was living in the floodplain. My house went completely under with all my housemates, and the community was really grappling with how we adapt to this. How do we respond to these events? And so picking up the pieces of our lives, whilst at the same time the landscape had really changed. There was all these massive landslips. There was the ground beneath our feet wasn't stable. You would drive down a road, and then on the way back the road would have shifted because it was so wet. So our world had changed, our social world had changed, but the landscape around us was changing too. And, you know, that's a landscape created by flood events, but these flood events were extraordinary. And so,
well, that really what's saying is that human desires will be moved around like furniture when it comes to nature.
Yes, and it makes me think actually of something that Tyson Yunkaporta, an Indigenous man who wrote Sand Talk, writes about, which is that if you don't move with the land will move you. Yeah. So during this time, there was an inquiry into the flood, and Oliver Costello, who is a Bundjalung man, who is part of the Fire Sticks Alliance, now known as Jargon Alliance, he kind of wrote about how these events would have been stories that his people would have told for many generations.
And it would have been warning signs.
Warning signs. They have something to say. The river tells the truth. It doesn't lie. And so what stories, if this is an act of communication, what is it saying to us? And then what are the stories we tell now going forward? So all of this is floating around in my headspace, right? And then I got an internship with the Jajarung Clan's Aboriginal Corporation down in Bendigo in Victoria. And I was like, awesome, cool, gonna leave behind the flooded Northern Rivers for a little bit, you know, had done, been involved in the cleanup and the rebuild and stuff. And I was like, I think I'm ready for a non-flooding landscape. And so I moved down there and
Well, Bendigo is pretty dry.
Well, yeah, but actually it flooded at that time too. We had the Central Victorian floods, so I felt like I was being chased around by storm clouds.
Yeah, maybe it was you.
Yeah, well, it is my fault. I'm sorry, everyone. When I moved down there, a friend of mine who I knew from forest activism was like, have you seen what's happening in the Wombat Forest? And I was like, no. So she sent me a bunch of media links and some Facebook posts. And yeah, essentially there had been a really big storm in 2021. And about 10,000 hectares of the forest had been impacted by these high severity winds. 3,000 hectares had been really heavily impacted. And so one of the scientists I talked to told me that it was like equivalent to a very severe bushfire. In some places, 80% of the canopy was lost. All of these trees stacked up on top of each other like pickup sticks. And so that community, like my community in Lismore, was grappling with this change in the landscape, not only the impacts on their lives and their homes and what that meant for them as people, but suddenly the landscape around them was changing and making sense of this landscape. But into that mix came, you know, very different worldviews and values. So the Jajarong Clan's Aboriginal Corporation thought that, well, saw this as a message, and it was quite devastating to see country in such a bad way. And they thought the trees should be removed, that they presented a fire risk, and that they it made it hard to move
the Jajarong thought this?
Yes.
Yes,
they,
cool.
They saw it as a fire risk and that it impeded
it
people.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime event.
A huge event that maybe was exacerbated by anthropogenic climate change, and then also the Wombat Forest has been a heavily impacted forest over time. So, you know, I guess the culmination of many human impacts over time. And so they thought the trees should be removed. And so to allow the understory to regenerate, and if there was timber removed in that process, then it made sense to use that timber. And so they ended up partnering with the Victorian government's logging agency, VicForest, to remove those trees. And then environmentalists thought the trees should remain there. And apart from roads and other areas where it made sense to remove them, that the forest should be left to recover by itself, that eventually the trees would break down into soil, they'd become habitat, that it was our responsibility to allow the forest to regenerate by itself. And so with these different worldviews came a lot of tension and conflict, and really tensions rose and communication broke down between these different groups. And so I guess I found myself in this place where I was kind of seeing these two different worlds. And when I first found out about it, it was quite confronting. I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to think. But then I have some really good mentors, got to sit down with and have a conversation about sitting in this complexity. And they were like, well, what do you know about this? Have you asked this question? I was like, no, I haven't asked these questions. So I got to begin to have conversations with people. And I realized that it was actually much more complicated than I initially thought. So I guess this project then has grown out of wanting to understand the different ways that people interact and know this forest, and the different values and worldviews and histories that they bring to it. And so that conflict, I guess, was kind of the impetus for this project beginning. But it's not what the project's about. The project is about the love that people have for this landscape, the different ways that they connect to it, and the diversity of perspectives that people bring. And so really grounding down into that curiosity and that love and what it means to feel connection to a landscape in our times of really monumental change.
Now tell me, you've already had an exhibition in Kyneton, and what was the general impression that people had? What was the response?
I think, well, on our opening, I thought it was going to be a little fair, maybe like 15 people, mostly my friends rocking up, but we had about 50 people there, which was...
And it's a country town.
It's a country town. It was very exciting, actually, to have that many people there, and I think it was generally really good. I got some nice messages of people saying that they really appreciated that the exhibition, it didn't assume that we couldn't understand nuance, that it really invited people to kind of sit in that. Yeah, I think along the way of doing this project as well, like I've spoken to many different people and I've been able to put them in contact, or if someone's kind of said something like, this person would be really good for you to talk to, they've got an interesting idea about that. And so it's been nice that in the practice of collecting interviews and putting together these stories, that I feel like these threads have begun to be woven between people as well. Part of the exhibition as well, one of the participants, Pete McCurley, who is a timber worker, also like a craftsman and an artist really, he's made a little vanilla lily tuba made of rock from the forest as well, which you can pick up and like handle and hold, and it kind of is a tether to place that he has contributed as well, which has been really beautiful to go along with all of these different portraits that are together in the room.
Yeah. Do you find that you're also bringing the forest into people's consciousness?
I would hope so. Yeah. I So the forest is there in the room as well. So the frames that are framing all the different portraits are made from wood from the forest. That came out of a community forest management trial about 20 years ago, which was a complicated process and in some ways really increased some divides within the community. But this wood came out of a selective thinning trial that was just sitting there and was donated to us to make the frames from. So all of the portraits are framed by the forest itself and kind of bringing this wood that maybe was part of some ruptures in the community, trying to bring it back into good story. And in the portraits as well, there's lots of sound. I spent a lot of time walking in the forest collecting bird song and just like the ambient sounds. And so they kind of sit there behind people's voices as well. So, yeah, I hope that the forest, people feel like the forest is in the room as well.
Has it helped you?
Yeah, it has. I think a lot of this project has just been about, for me, like sitting in tension and sitting in conflict. And it's, I went into it because I had a lot of questions I just wanted to ask people. And like really, I don't think I really answered all those questions, but it's not about finding the right answer. It was about kind of understanding the complexity and learning to sit in that. And I really felt like I was so delighted by the different ways that people shared with me and their connections to place and the layers of which they felt that. So, for example, like interviewing scientists who, you know, they often got their head down in the data. It's often quite they're quite serious, or, you know, you have the academic papers and it's kind of stripped of emotion because that's the way that we do science in the Western world. Them being able to share with me their feelings of grief or what it's like to be studying disturbance events and those layers there, they're not just unthinking or unfeeling humans. They're full humans, and they have their places they like to go and the things that they grieve and their lives and their worlds. And so, you know, being invited into that was really special.
Did you find that people were very happy because nobody generally asks them their opinion about this particular subject?
Yeah, for some people it was a real relief to be able to talk about this. So not just because, I mean, often when we focus on forests, like often it's about the forest wars, forest conflicts, the fights, the different, there's a lot of conflict involved in the discourse, I suppose. So being able to step back and be like, well, what is it that, where do you go when you go in the forest? Why do you return there? Like, what do you notice? What do you look for? What does this place mean for you? And like grounding it in our love for place and our sense of responsibility to place, I think was really, was powerful for me as well. And it's like, yes, we know that these conflicts are there. And we know that, you know, forests are places where they're places of conflict. I know, you know, I go to a forest to find maybe a bit of peace, maybe kind of disconnection from the intensity of being a contemporary human and maybe connection with the natural world. But there are also places that have been, you know, heavily disturbed over time. There are places where people have been kicked off their land. Like, there are places where violence and tension and conflict has occurred. And so it makes sense that there are conflicts around them. But they also are this, like, this thing that holds us all and kind of invites us all back in. And I think that the way that so many different people find that sense of connection to place and a kind of it holds us all together. And that was really beautiful and powerful for me as well, seeing how the forest is this thing that, despite all of the different ways that we live our lives and the different values that we have, that it's kind of this common ground that we all find ourselves returning to.
Now, it's got more legs, this exhibition, hasn't it? It's going to Daylesford.
Yeah, it's going to Daylesford. So one of the interviewees, Gary Lawrence, is a local historian, and he's a big advocate of the mineral springs. He's a curator of the local Daylesford Museum as well. And so he invited us to have the exhibition there, which is incredibly exciting. So they have all of some archival materials, some old machinery from the days of the logging, the mining and the wombat that they are putting on display alongside the portrait, along with photography from the forest as well, of local environment groups.
So when's that?
That will be from the 8th of March, so that long weekend, until the 21st of March. And on the 15th of March, which is that middle weekend, there will be like an opening event where Caleb Denoli Lee, who is part of the Jara Cultural Heritage team, will come and also be doing some interpretation of the Jajarung Cultural Heritage Collection they have at the Historical Society as well. So it's really exciting to have that kind of collaborative approach and lots of different people bringing their different parts to this as well. Yeah, so Daylesford Museum, you can find us under their upcoming exhibitions. We have a website. So this exhibition is an, I feel like it's better if you're there in person because it's really beautiful. Yeah. But it is also online. So we have a website, framingwombatforest.com.au, where you can find all of the audio portraits, all of the photographic portraits and a bit more information there online. So if you can't make it out, you can go there too. And then we have a Facebook page. So you can find us in lots of different places.
Thanks very much for talking to us, Tessa.
Thank you so much for your time.